when these burst, it's going to unleash an enormous amount of anger. Mm-hmm. People will feel like they were played.
Yeah.
They were played by the system that they had intended to upend. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that we're really recognizing the hostility that is likely to unleash. Mm.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview between Stephanie Pomboy and socionomics expert Peter Atwater. If you haven't yet watched part one of this discussion, in which Peter explains why he sees massive market destruction ahead as the current confidence cycle unwinds, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. We also discuss strategies that investors should consider taking right now while the current relief rally in stocks is underway. So stick around to the end for that. Okay, well, let's get started watching part two of Stephanie Pomboy's interview with Peter Atwater.
But talk to me about how you analyzed crypto throughout this entire boom and the bust and where you see us going.
Yeah, so I mean, crypto is fascinating to me because in the past 10 years, we've seen two bubbles. So there was the bubble where grandma was talking about it at Thanksgiving in 2017. And now we have had this second bubble that, you know, peaked early last year. And what's different about them is the cultishness of this second wave. And I think it speaks to the point that you've just raised, which is nobody has thrown in the hat. Mm-hmm. We've seen stable coins collapse, but it hasn't shaken confidence really at all among the ardent believers. And that's a really interesting phenomenon. And it's not just crypto. I would say the same behavior exists with ARK. The same behavior exists with, you know, Tesla and some of the Musk-related world. But what we have is investing as cult behavior. And people are going to get, you know, bothered by my use of that word. But I think it's a really critical term to describe this blind followership, this reliance on conspiracy theory-esque information, and most importantly, the existential risk that comes with that such strident belief that to believe otherwise brings unbelievable anger, frustration, that I don't think we're quite appreciative of, that when these burst, it's going to unleash an enormous amount of anger. Mm-hmm. People will feel like they were played. They were played by the system that they had intended to upend. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that we're really recognizing the hostility that is likely to unleash.
No, I think that's a really good point, because I mean, you need barely scan any Twitter commentary related to crypto and you can see, you know, the people who believe in crypto, their reaction to anyone who dare, you know, impugn its sanctity is, it has really no basis in an argument. It's really just more, you know, personal attacks and that sort of thing. It definitely gives you that sense that it's much more rooted in some kind of emotion than it is in an intellectual thesis, or maybe it was intellectual and it's become so emotional now that that's what's driving it. But I, you know, my brother told me that the retort to people who don't get crypto is have fun staying poor. And I thought he was joking. He said, no, you could go online, you can buy t-shirts that say have fun staying poor. And I thought, well, that perfectly sums up. I mean, that's sort of a perfect embodiment of the argument was, well, you obviously don't get it, so I'm not even gonna try to explain it to you. So when you talk about the anger associated with seeing this collapse, does that manifest in a social disruption way, or do you think it manifests in a way that's just, I mean, how do they, what's the reaction? Do they try to sue the crypto company? How does that play out in your view?
So I would be paying very close attention to who do they blame? Mm-hmm. Who do they assign as the scapegoat? Who betrayed them? Mm-hmm. And here I think that you've got individuals and organizations that are highly vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Think of this as you know, if you go back to when confidence was really low in 2011, we had Occupy Wall Street. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a similar social phenomenon, but with outrage. And I don't think those that enabled this and candidly manipulated prices appreciate the anger that is going to be laid at them. Mm-hmm. The money business is great until people start losing money.
Yeah.
And when people start losing money, they don't turn responsibility on themselves. They turn responsibility to somebody else.
Yeah.
And in an institutional world, yes, they would sue each other. I'm not convinced in this environment people are going to wait around for courts to behave.
Right. And there are several, high profile individuals who just seem like they would be obviously, blamed for it because they were so vociferous in their, advocacy of a lot of these cryptos. So, it shall be interesting. But I on a totally separate topic, we mentioned briefly the stablecoin thing. And when I was reading this write-up about the whole Luna Terra situation, one thing that immediately hit me, we were talking about how the traders were really supposed to ensure that it never broke the dollar peg. And just reading the description of that just sounded like it had echoes to the authorized participants and the ETFs and how they are supposed to magically make sure that, markets are always liquid and whatnot. And then flashing back, of course, to the specialists in 1987, it was never supposed to crash because the specialists were supposed to make markets. And somehow all these people who are supposed to do X, Y, and Z never happen to do X, Y, and Z when it's supposed to occur. That ETF concern has obviously slipped way off the radar screen. And I'm wondering, do you think that's still a potential issue in the event that we have, a further meltdown here, or is it?
Yeah, I think that risk exists. I think we've seen a potential coming attraction in terms of what happened in the nickel market in London, where, to your point, participants didn't behave the way folks expected them to. You saw trades unwound. You saw that the exchange itself come under attack and criticism. And so I do worry about the system's ability to handle volumes in a material evaporation of confidence. We have all of these products that have experienced wonderful inflows over long periods of time that have yet to be stress tested on the way down. And you know, the presumption that there will be liquidity, that participants will act accordingly, I don't think that's what history suggests. And I worry that we have a financial system that has been supported anecdotally by the notion of these locks that you know trigger events that you know will slow down the market, will close the market, that those will be sufficient. And I don't think we've given much thought to them as not just consequence, but cause. So, you know, as you begin to approach trigger points, you cause trigger points to happen. Mm-hmm. And once they happen, do you essentially create the anticipation of them happening again? Yeah. That we become primed for them to happen, therefore cause them to happen. Mm-hmm. And so I you know focus a fair amount on you know what happens when you can't open a market, and particularly in an environment where you have leveraged instruments up and down, that all of those participants assumed that they would either be the beneficiary or victim of markets that were fluid. Mm-hmm. And so fluidity is something that I, you know, what happens when things aren't fluid? And maybe it's because I lived through it, you know, running an asset management organization after 9/11, but you realize that, you know, when things close, that's a problem.
Yeah. Especially if you have retail investors who are promised that they can get out at that minute or hour or whatever. So then you really have a problem. So just to quickly go back for sort of a final question, and that is, you know, when you keep going back to this idea that the confidence in the central banks is reflected in that negative interest rates and that, you know, that bubble unwinds, which, you know, I infer to mean that you expect interest rates to move sharply higher. And then you had mentioned earlier that you do see food and energy prices remaining sticky and wages as well, just because you've got to keep up with those food and energy prices if you want to, you know, keep your workers working. So in that scenario, you know, what do you see, how far do you see rates going, you know, and does it get arrested by a Fed saying, all right, you know, we're not going to raise rates anymore? How do you see the interest rate outlook, let's say from here to the end of the year? Is that too narrow a question for you?
Yeah. So a couple of things. I think that policymakers follow the market. Mm-hmm.
I agree with that.
So I think the notion that the Fed is leading this is incorrect. Mm-hmm. You know, any sort of committee that lives by consensus is inherently a lagging behavior. So this is going to be market driven, not Fed driven. And the challenge, to circle back to something that I spoke of before, is volatile people behave volatilely. So as we've seen already with the increase in rates since the lows of 2020, volatile people can move the bond market intensely. Mm-hmm. And here, I think we need to be particularly conscious of what a marked-to-market economy we live in today. So I don't think the connection between the financial markets and the real economy has ever been tighter than it is today. And you and I don't buy anything without knowing what the market is for it, whether it's checking Zillow to buy a house or, you know, so So what happens in a market today is moving the real economy moments later. And I looked specifically, for example, at what happened to gas prices in early March. I mean, we're talking hours between where crude was trading and what happened at the pump. So the challenge for rates, for the economy, is all comes down to market stability. And will we see, you know, calmness return to the bond market? And here, I think your point about corporate credit becomes imperative. Your point about liquidity becomes imperative. Because if people need liquidity, the time preference shifts to immediate, which is devastating for the bond market, is devastating for the equity market, is devastating for the housing market. And so those markets have the potential to feed immediately into an economy and not create a recession, but to create an overnight depression, that the markets crash the economy.
Well, that's sort of a natural consequence of inflating the largest bubble in the history of mankind and then running around with a pin thinking that you can somehow, you know, gradually deflate it and have a softish landing in the economy. But, you know, we've seen the Fed attempt this feat of daring do in the past with spectacular results, none of them good. But no, I appreciate that clarification, because I agree with you too that, you know, it's important to draw a distinction between the treasury market and the corporate market as well, because, you know, speculators might begin to anticipate that the Fed's not going to raise rates as much and start covering their short positions in treasuries, even as they're, you know, unwinding some of their corporate risk. But anyway, thank you so much for your time, Peter. This has been even more fascinating than I thought. You know, I was preparing for great insights, but I could go on for hours. I want to give you an opportunity to just tell all the followers on Wealthion where they can find you if they're not fortunate enough to be a student at William & Mary.
So you know, you can find me on Twitter at Peter_Atwater. I also, you know, write, as Stephanie knows, a weekly commentary that is targeted for institutional investors. I don't do work for retail investors, principally because, as you might expect, I can be very contrarian, and I hate to see people spend money buying advice that they will never use, because, you know, I'm the guy who says, run into that burning building, get out of the hot tub and put down the bottle of champagne. But I do that as well. And then I write from time to time for the Financial Times and other places where you can find my thoughts. And I would say, most of all, I don't want people to think that I'm a pessimist or bearer. I am a optimist and I am an agnostic investor. There have been times when I have been incredibly bullish. If you go back and read what I was writing in March of 2020, I was probably as excited as I've ever been for the opportunities that were ahead, which was hard to imagine in that moment.
Well, thank you again. It's been such a pleasure. I love catching up with you always. Hopefully we'll get to do it in person one of these days soon. It's been way too long. Yeah. And for you viewers out there, thank you very much for your patience with me as a guest host this week. Hopefully nothing burned down this week either. But if you're enjoying the Wealthion subscription channel, I'm sorry, the YouTube channel, please remember to like and subscribe and keep on watching. And I guess if you are looking for some way to get some investment advice, Wealthion has some advisors that they recommend, and you can go on their website and sign up for a free consultation. So there you go. Thank you so much for watching. And thank you, Peter. Great to see you.
Great to see you, Stephanie. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Well, now's the time in the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the endorsed financial advisors by Wealthion. I'm joined as usual by John Lodra and Mike Preston. John, let's start with you. Love to get your general reaction to Stephanie and Peter's conversation, but in particular, I'd like to get your reaction to a point Peter made, which is that bear markets don't end on fatigue. You know, he said that people are pretty sick and tired of the declines in the market since the beginning of the year, but they're not really panicked yet. And his point was that, you know, bear markets end when people have just given up on stocks, and confidence-wise, which of course is the key metric that Peter looks at, you know, they might be irritated, they might be tired, but they're not panicked yet. So what's your takeaway on this difference between fatigue and fear?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. First, I'd like to say a fabulous surrogate in Stephanie Pomboy sitting in for you today on the hosting. She's great, and I hope we get to see more of her, taking nothing away from you, of course.
Me too. I'm right there with you.
Yeah. Well, so here's the deal. You know, and I like to, Peter used the analogy of a long car trip with the family where the kids are whining in the back seat. Are we there yet? And so he said, you know, markets don't typically die of fatigue or whining, as he said, which is kind of apropos. I mean, absolutely. You know, when you look at real bear market end stages, think about the housing bust in 2009, ending, you know, bottoming in March of 2009. Think about the tech bubble bust finally bottoming in 2002. Those typically bottom not just with social mood and sentiment being utterly disgusted. Mike and I can remember almost like yesterday seeing peers of ours in our industry who have preached their whole careers about dollar cost averaging into the market within weeks, if not days of the low, talking about dollar cost averaging out of the market in 2009. That's what real fear and panic and capitulation look like. We're certainly not seeing that right now. And if we paint a picture that we've talked about over the last few weeks, Adam, with your videos, we do think we're likely in a regime change of a multi-year bull market, as artificial as much of that has been, in our opinion, due to monetary policy. We do think we're in a regime change to more of a, probably a bear market, but one that will likely be punctuated by some very short-term rallies, even vicious rallies to the upside. And if you look just recently, the S&P 500, for example, bounced pretty strongly off its, you know, two standard deviation downside oversold move to its 50-day moving average. And we're right now today, after a pretty strong day in the market today, we're on June 2nd, it's right just below its 200-day moving average, which these kind of technical measures start to become really turned upside down when there's a regime change. So, for example, in a bull market, the 200-day moving average might be a very reliable level of support, technical support. Whereas in a bear market, we'll see, of course, soon enough, it may likely turn into a more ironclad overhead resistance, meaning the market might likely turn down from here. That's the kind of regime change we're seeing here. But absolutely nothing about this feels like fear, disgust, and throwing in the towel. It feels just like Peter talked about, you know, fatigue and maybe a little bit of whining. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way.
Yeah. And I hate to, you know, sort of deliver this message to folks, because there are folks there that are looking at, you know, I think the average investor who's long the average most popular stocks, you know, is still down a fair amount, even with this recent bounce. You know, certainly if you're holding tech stocks, especially if you're not holding the big, you know, five, you could still be sitting on losses of over 30, 40% or whatnot. And to hear that, hey, you know, the worst of the abuse has yet to arrive, is probably going to be a bit of a depressing message here. But we're saying it not because we're necessarily rooting for it, but we're just trying to prevent people from getting too sanguine of, okay, bounce is here, you know, don't have to worry anymore, right? You know, just buy the dip and we're going to be back to all-time highs in a heartbeat. Who knows where we're going to go from here? But as we've been talking on this channel a lot, John, and you just reinforced, you know, bear markets are punctuated by, you know, can be punctuated by pretty prodigious relief rallies. And the key thing is to not mistake them as a secular turnaround and instead use them oftentimes as opportunities to unload, reduce your equity exposure, but at a higher price than where you were before the bounce. All right, Mike, let's come to you. I know you took pretty good notes on this one. I guess maybe I'll just sort of put out the general point that Peter made, which is that when you have a confidence cycle ending like he believes we have right now, he says everything that can go wrong will go wrong. There's sort of a cascading effect that tends to happen in here. So, you know, again, that's another reason to kind of look to the future with maybe a more defensive eye. What else do you take from this?
Yeah, I mean, Peter talks about how everything was working right. I mean, all cylinders were firing in favor of the market, the economy, investment, et cetera, et cetera. You know, free money that's gone on for so long is likely now reversing. We just saw, as Peter says, one of the biggest jumps in junk yields ever, you know, junk bond yields. And junk bonds are bonds from companies that are, you know, rated below BBB in terms of their financial strength rating. We've seen a move from 4% to 7.5% in just a couple of months. That's a big deal. It's going to make new investment hard. It's going to make mergers and acquisitions harder. It's going to reveal the zombie companies out there that wouldn't exist if we weren't in a free money era. And some people estimate we might have as much as 15 to 20% zombie companies out there that are just existing because of this free money error. You know, Peter talks a lot about socionomics. He writes a lot about socionomics, and he rightfully gives credit to Robert Prechter as kind of writing a lot or even creating this whole area of study, Robert Prechter at Elliott Wave International. And it's pretty clear to me from reading these documents, and I've read certainly a lot of Prechter's stuff about socionomics, that we are in an era or the end of an era of peak social mood. And human beings are very predisposed to being optimistic, and generally that helps a lot. It helps us survive over hundreds and even thousands of years. But when you're in a fourth turning, like we think that we are, and you're in a regime change, something that starkly says the future 10 years is going to look a lot different than the last 10 or 20, then optimism may cause you to overstay the party. You know, case in point, I think Steph said this, if you turn on the financial news now, really all you'll see is, you know, what to buy, what's the next play going to be? How do I get in? Where am I going to expose myself? It's not like, how do I shore up the ship? It's like, what do I do now to buy this dip and get in? And there's been sectors of our economy and certain people that have benefited dramatically by this. And this feeds into how social mood can shift and become a problem. I think Steph talked about the Teflon high end. You know, when money's free, you can borrow almost to infinity and you can really leverage things so that they benefit you a bit. Peter talked about how you could take out debt, never sell assets, die with that debt, die with the assets. And then your heirs could basically get a tax step up and never pay tax. It's really kind of an unfair system in a way, the way that these bubbles have been created and propagated throughout the years. And that all seems to be changing. And, you know, here's the punchline. It can make people really angry. It's an unfair system. And we have the potential for bubbles bursting. There was some talk about Bitcoin, but it's not just Bitcoin bubble that's bursting. It's likely the stock market and maybe even the housing market. So that can make people pretty angry, and there's a lot of risk in that. And I think it's just smart to think about the potential risks and educate people on really how unfair and how big of a bubble this whole thing has been.
Yeah, and to your list of markets that are vulnerable, I'd put the jobs market on there too, right? Which again, disproportionately hurts the bottom 90% when that bursts. I really detected that from Peter, that he really did seem to have a very pronounced concern for the fact that the bottom 90%, I don't know if you use that specific percentage, but that's kind of what I got, is you had your Teflon elites, right? And then you have everybody else. And he definitely seemed to be very concerned that the everybody else bucket is getting increasingly squeezed here. And he didn't use these exact words, but it was to the effect of that desperate people behave desperately, right? I really kind of detected an undercurrent of just sort of like fear of a fraying of the social order if we continue going on the trajectory that we're on here. I'm not trying to freak people out. I'm just trying to say that that was, you know, something understandable that I took from Peter's, you know, seemed to be genuine concern there. And look, you know, hopefully that doesn't mean it's going to be Lord of the Flies, you know, in the streets tomorrow. But it does mean, I think, if we're sort of putting on the list of things that are more probable over the next decade, to have more sort of class friction in the US as people get more and more irritated by the unfairness that you were just talking about there, Mike, and that most of the injuries that are happening right now, they impact that bottom half a lot more. You know, sure, if you're super wealthy and you lose half your wealth, you know, boohoo, you're still, you know, on a relative basis, very well off, and you still have most of your assets, right? Where if your standard of living drops in half, and you're already in the bottom half of today's society, that's just, you know, hanging by your fingernail to get by, that's a big deal. All right, so you mentioned kind of bubbles and the danger of what happens when bubbles burst or unwind. One thing that Peter mentioned I thought was interesting, and I'll go to you, John, for this, is that he said that bubbles tend to unwind on a FIFO basis, which means that the late stage craziness, you know, the things that just go bananas that have no business reacting that way price-wise, they all tend to happen at the end of a bubble mania. And those tend to be the first ones that come back down to earth. They crash the hardest and the fastest. And, you know, he mentioned things like SPACs, things like meme stocks, you know, certain cryptos, et cetera. And I think we've already seen that. We've seen a lot of things pre-crash here. The SPAC market's pretty much dried up. The meme stocks have pretty much given up all their gains. We got a lot of cryptos that are down 90%, that type of thing. And now it's bleeding more towards, I guess, what we would consider to be more, you know, stalwart assets. You know, Peter was talking specifically about the big tech companies that have driven a lot of the run-up over the past decade, that they're now finally beginning to take the pain. So I'd love to get your thoughts on this. You know, clearly, to our earlier comments about a true bear market, you know, we don't think that there's enough pain there yet for this to really be a proper bear market yet. You know, how much more of the unwind, I guess, do you see happening from here? You know, which inning, you know, kind of are we in, if you had to guess?
Yeah, no, Adam, I too, just a quick technical correction. You said FIFO, I think you meant to say LIFO. LIFO is an accounting term for last in, first out.
You're exactly right. I did, sorry, folks, wrote my notes wrong. LIFO, last in, first out. Yeah.
So for those that aren't familiar with the accounting term, LIFO is last in, first out, FIFO is, but yeah, the point there is, and I think it really ties very nicely into this social mood, psychological component in a big cyclical bubble bull market turning into a bear market, which is what we believe we're doing. You know, and if you imagine, and we've got some great, like, you know, charts that we've used to illustrate, you know, there's this, you know, five stages of grief or denial, both in bear markets and bull markets. And early on, I mean, think back, you know, 6-7 years ago, folks were like, you know, hey, I can't, you know, this market's bounced pretty strongly off of the housing bubble bust, must be getting toppy here. And, you know, but then yet things keep going, right? And so what happens is folks in mass start to let down their skepticism. They start to let down their due diligence, if you will. And what you get is things like SPACs, which, if you think about what a SPAC is, it's basically a circumvention of the normal way of a company going public, where a vehicle, sometimes with outlandish names, almost like tongue-in-cheek names, at you know, at the investors, say, hey, give us money, we're gonna invest in a yet to be named, you know, company or sector, but trust us, we're gonna do good for you, you know. And it's a way to kind of circumvent a public offering, which has all kinds of protections for investors that SPACs don't have. That's emblematic of investors saying, you know what, this is so good, I don't even have to think and be skeptical about it, right? And that's what happens in a late stage of a bubble market. And guess what? Those things that you don't think about or aren't skeptical of, whether you're talking SPACs or you know, a bunch of corporate debt was issued over the last bunch of years, which is called covenant light debt, which failed to have much of the protections that traditionally corporate debt would have for investors. This is what happens. And it's that stuff that, you know, just like the subprime debt in the housing bubble, It was that too good to be true that investors jumped into because of the yield promises, and they completely pulled the wool over their eyes, or was pulled over their eyes by, you know, rating agencies saying this is good stuff. They let their defenses down. And that's the stuff that tends to, you know, when you, you know, get people to pile in last because it sounds too good to be true, and it is. And when that starts to unravel, it has typically a contagion and an unraveling effect in reverse. So yeah, I think we're just in the early innings. And one little kind of anecdote, you know, you talk about the housing market. You know, we've seen mortgage demand be pretty weak recently, even with some modest pullbacks in interest rates. Those are what you start to see when things start to turn, right? When they start to turn and turn a corner, where even things that would be greeted with, you know, some reception, oh, mortgage rates have dropped a little bit, let's go buy a house. No, let's not, because I'm scared and things are going to get much worse.
Right. They might drop further. Right. And again, that's really at the heart of what I understand to be Peter's field of study here, right? The socionomics, right? Which is all about confidence. And he's talking about the end of a confidence cycle. And that's a great example, John, where all of a sudden people don't have as much confidence in the housing market as they did just a year ago, right? You know, a year ago, if mortgage rates had come down, we would have seen a massive spike in applications and new purchases, because people would have been jumping on that. But now they're like, I don't know, you know, rates may be going higher from here. All right. So, John, you know, what you're beating on here is as a speculative bubble like we've seen in a lot of, you know, you could argue almost every asset, you know, over the past several years, begins to unwind. One, it does happen on a LIFO basis, but two, what essentially it is it's a repricing of risk, right? You use SPACs as a great example, where that's where investors just all of a sudden said, look, you know, we're not worried. We're going to put risk concerns aside, and we're going to go whole hog on this cool new thing that you're getting me excited about, right? And now we're waking up the next morning and saying, ah, God, that was probably pretty reckless. You know, probably shouldn't do that again, right? And as you said, we're sort of in the early innings of this. So, Mike, I'm coming to you now, but it does seem like we are entering an era where risk is going to become more fairly priced in the system. And usually that means investors are going to demand higher yields or higher prices or higher premiums to compensate for the amount of risk in an investment. And I want to tie this to a comment that Peter made, where he said, as interest rates continue to rise, confidence in the central bankers will continue to decrease. And he basically said that, look, I think that the bond market is kind of the best barometer we have for confidence in central banks. Confidence in central banks had been super high, maybe even historically high over the past decade. And as a consequence, yields were really low, but now they're coming up. And what that does is, it's really interesting, is you know, you can get yields with an overly indebted system like ours that go up so high that they basically start collapsing the system. Right, Mike, you mentioned that 15 to 20% of companies are zombie companies. We've got companies that are just addicted to access to credit, and access to credit at historically low rates. That access becomes harder and that debt becomes more expensive. All of a sudden, those companies start getting in real trouble. So Peter said, you got to kind of begin to worry about collapse because of that. Or if we avoid collapse, we may avoid it by hyperinflation, and then you get to worry about hyperinflation, right? And I just had a really long, fascinating interview with Lynn Alden this morning, and she talked about that she expects at some point in time that the Fed is going to have to resort to yield curve control, which, for folks who don't understand what that is, that's when the Fed comes in and says, I know yields want to go higher, but we're going to buy as much as it takes of these bonds to keep yields where we want them to be. The problem is there's no free lunch in the world, and you have to pay the price of the market, you know, the market's loss of faith in you another way. Japan is doing this right now. They're implementing yield curve control, and the way the market is basically punishing them for it is strongly devaluing the yen. So that was sort of Peter's warning flag about, you got to worry about hyperinflation, right? If we end up going to a period of time where the Fed starts intervening to keep yields from crashing the system, well, then the actual purchasing power of the currency might decline. So, Mike, I'd love to hear kind of your thoughts on that, but also we are now beginning to see a little bit of life today in gold and then the miners and whatnot. And look, one day a trend doesn't make. But I thought it was sort of interesting to see what happened in the precious metals market today, given that point that Peter just made. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think that it is all about confidence in the Fed. And I think you put it really well, because it's not just about confidence in the Fed. It's also about ultimately confidence in the currency. And the Fed has gotten away with a lot over the last 12 years. And you might argue that their initial response to the housing crisis, the 08-09 crisis, was warranted. But every single add-on action after that was almost certainly not warranted. You know, they've created a very dangerous system in which we require that we stay at the most overvalued point in history, mathematically, forever and ever. If not, it's a threat to our entire way of living. That's not a sustainable system. And, you know, look at almost any program on the financial news, and 80 or 90% of what's talked about, 80 or 90% of the time, is central banks and what they're doing. And so their response has been more and more and more. And like you just talked about with yield control, that would just be another example of more. And each time they do more and we allow them to do more, it brings us closer and closer to a risky point. You know, a collapse in stock prices is simply just a change in the risk premium preferences amongst investors. If you have a crash of 20 or 30 or 40% in a day, that can happen in a split second with no trades in between, and all of that wealth just vaporizes. So there's a big part of it, this wealth effect, that's not real. It's fake. There's a part of our money system that's fake to some extent, and that's kind of the whole point, in that we want to create this illusion of wealth, and we do so by money printing, and we can do so because of our world reserve currency status, and that's because of our ongoing trade deficit. But I'd like to see more freedom come back into the markets. We talked earlier about how unfair it is. That's not right. There should be some kind of reversion to the mean to create a more fair system. That would be what I would hope for. The problem is people get hurt along the way. And disproportionately, it's probably the people that didn't take as much of a comfortable ride on the way up. So yeah, it's all about confidence in the central bank. I actually hope that confidence is ultimately lost, even if it comes at a price, because it'll give us a chance for a freer, more just system.
Yeah, and you know, that opinion can sometimes make people interpret that we're rooting for collapse because we like people to be hurt. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. But to a certain extent, you know, you want to get it over with, right? So that we can get back to a truer, more sustainable, more fair baseline faster. And of course, the longer you delay and distort, the more painful the process of the eventual reckoning is going to be. So to a certain extent, yeah, you actually kind of want it to happen sooner rather than later. You know, I'm going to make an observation that might not be super popular, but, you know, one of the reasons why I kind of do Wealthion is to educate people so that they can take prudent action today, given whatever they think is most likely to happen tomorrow. But given all the storm clouds that we see, you know, I think folks should be preparing for tougher times ahead. And I do think it's disproportionately going to hurt, you know, the lower echelons of society. And yes, they do not deserve it. I want to make that really clear. But kind of as a whole, we are responsible for the government that we let remain in place. And I know there's going to be a lot of people that say, hey, look, the voting system's, you know, super rigged, and it's not a fair, you know, the election system isn't fair, and all that type of stuff. And I'm not saying it is completely fair. But where I'm going with this is, you know, we have people that we have allowed to run the show and continue to let run the show who have a pretty terrible track record. And after a certain point, it's sort of like shame on us for expecting them to do anything differently. And today's reminder of that was, or this week's reminder of that was, Janet Yellen getting in front of the camera and basically saying, you know, the CNN sort of played a montage of a number of, you know, comments she made throughout 2021, saying that inflation's not going to be a big issue. It's going to be over pretty soon, and I'm not worried about it. And then obviously, you know, it became a major issue. And, you know, she said, boy, you know, I guess I got it wrong, right? Now, this woman ran the Federal Reserve. She's running our Treasury, right? Presumably, she's got access to better information than probably almost any human on the planet. And yet she got it so colossally wrong, because those soundbite statements are like a year old. You know, it wasn't all that long ago, right? And lots of people watching this program, a number of the people that I had on this program a year ago, you know, they arguably, I don't want to say that they saw it coming with exactitude, but they said, yeah, you know, you flood the system with $4 trillion in monetary stimulus and $6 trillion in fiscal stimulus within, you know, a little bit more than a year. And yeah, you're probably going to have some pretty big inflation coming out of that. So, John, I'll come back to you and kind of let you wrap up on this. But, you know, to a certain extent, letting leaders like this persist, we're kind of getting the management we deserve in some ways, sadly. Do you agree?
Yeah, Adam. And you know, I think the big thing that gets lost here is that this problem that's now, you know, compelling Janet Yellen to say I was wrong, this isn't a recent problem. The seeds for this was planted many years ago.
Yeah.
You know, so for example, if you look back and look at some rules-based monetary policy theory that goes back decades, you know, Taylor rule, for example, not to get too wonky here, but the central bankers went off script, way off their own set of tools, without any compass to say, is this right? You know, completely experimental territory. And one way to look at that is when COVID came around, they were already way in over their heads. And what they felt they had to do was, it was the wrong time to be doing it, because we were already so, the seeds have already been planted for this kind of inflationary thing. So yeah, we messed up, we got it wrong a year ago. No, you got it wrong a lot of years ago, and you kept doubling down. And that's what happened. And now we're in this phase where that's coming home to roost, we believe. And I don't say this from a political or personal bias standpoint. Just look at the data. Look at how crazy valuations have been unleashed from any historical norms. Look at how narrow credit spreads have gotten, which is, you know, an artificial, check in the box that risk is not there. You know, these are all things that have been years in the making. And yeah, a lot of blame should go back, you know, to our leaders and policymakers that, you know, it's not just a recent thing. This has happened over several years.
Yeah. And all that's very true. And I guess where I'm going with this too is, like, you know, that we can argue whether there should be a Federal Reserve in the first place, right? Should we have an institution that's sort of setting the price of money and setting interest rates? Or should we have a market-based solution for that? And that's a topic for a different day. But to your point about sort of deviating from their rules, the Fed is supposed to be the adult in the room, right? Who removes the punch bowl once the party really starts getting started, right? And they really shifted from that to being the guy who spikes the punch once the party, you know, starts getting started. And they were encouraged and applauded by previous administrations, both Republican and Democrat, right? Because it served the short-term needs of those folks who were in office. And to be honest, you know, the public kind of cheers any kind of central intervention as long as it, you know, results in a near-term pop in their pocketbooks, right? So, we're gonna need a return to some of the old school values of, look, you know, there is no free lunch. You can't party today on tomorrow's dime. That type of stuff. And, you know, part of that's just going to be, you know, doing more adulting, I guess, as a society in giving up, fun times today, hopefully in return for longer term, you know, sustainability and sustained prosperity. But I don't see too many people really talking about that credibly yet. And I'm sure I got a lot of head nodders, you know, in the folks watching this right now. So maybe I'm just stating the obvious. But I think until and unless we start really adopting that as a nation, meaning it's part of the national dialogue, especially when we have, you know, elections, we're probably just going to get more of the same until then. All right, Mike, sorry to have opined so much, folks, on this, but Mike, I'll let you wrap it up here. I know you guys are talking to people day in, day out who are wrestling with the real challenges in this market of, hey, you know, how do I preserve my wealth? How do I allocate, you know, what I have, et cetera? Anything in particular that you are noticing that people are calling with in terms of like key questions, key fears, et cetera? And do you have any just sort of general advice for folks watching right now, given what's going on?
I guess I'd say a few weeks ago when the S&P was down 20% or touched 20%, I don't think it actually ever closed down 20% or more, which is the technical definition of a bear market. There were a bunch of people that were very concerned, you know, and they were hoping the market would go back up next week or the week after so that they could lighten up their overweighted positions. A lot of people are overweighted. They certainly don't like the psychology of losing. And I think that Peter talked about that too. You know, there's when you're managing money for people and people lose money, even a little bit, it's psychologically very difficult. And we were seeing that a few weeks ago. And I've got to be honest, we're not really seeing it now or last week. So there's a marked difference. And the S&P only went from about minus 20% to about minus 13.5% right now. And so just take that in for a minute. We are 13% off the all-time insane overvalued point that we reached in either November or January, depending upon which index you look at. So we're very, very close to the high. We've had a major rally, which we think is a bear market rally. People are in general, based on a relatively small sample size, I admit, less concerned now than they were a few weeks ago. Now is the time to rebalance, to reduce risk, to reduce exposure to stocks. Not then, although even if you reduced back then a few weeks ago, I still think those are good prices to sell relative to what we're likely to see in future months and years. So that's it. There's just less worry out there, which frankly is, from a contrarian standpoint, means that you should worry a little bit and use that to rebalance and to reduce risk and get to an allocation that you're going to be okay with sitting with throughout the whole thing. The last point I'd make is we're not telling people to panic. Just really evaluate where you are. Evaluate whether you're going to be able to stick through that. If you're a passive investor and literally going to stay with it through thick and thin, that's okay. But I really think that people are underestimating the risk in the market and underestimating their ability to sit through it. So that's all I'd say.
That's a great point, though, which is use this current environment to take action, whatever that smart action is going to be for you. You know, I've seen some of the emails that come your guys' way, and you're right, Mike. I remember just a little while ago when, you know, markets were at their low, there were people that were clearly going through the stages of grief, right? And, you know, denial is the first, but then you get to bargaining, right? Where they're just like, God, please, if the market could just get up a little bit, I'll be good. I'll reduce my exposure. I just don't make me sell right now at these horrible losses. And then of course, when the market recovers, you know, people start getting caught by that siren sound of the market. Well, what if I just hold on a little bit more? And hey, maybe this is actually gonna go back to all-time highs and maybe I shouldn't sell it just yet, right? So it really is to try to, you know, use the gift that you've been given here of this bounce, that if you've got too much exposure in certain areas, use this as the responsible time to lighten up on them. Also, Mike, you know, you talked about, you know, kind of right-sizing, you know, selling enough to right-size your positions. For folks that don't know how to do that, I'll just reiterate my weekly advice to work with a professional financial advisor to find that right balance for you. Ideally, one that understands the trends and the risks that Stephanie and Peter and Mike and John and I have been talking about here. If you've got a good one, great. Give them a call, schedule a time to do that. If you don't, or you'd like the second opinion of an informed advisor, Mike and John and their team at New Harbor, they're one of the key financial advisors endorsed by Wealthion. You can schedule a free, no strings attached portfolio review from them. It doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to work with them. They'll just do it out of the goodness of their hearts, trying to help people out. If you want to learn more about how to do that, just stick around at the end of this video. It's coming up in a second, and we tell you how to do that. It only takes you a couple seconds. Mike, I was also going to ask you about the miners, given this bounce that we're having here and that it's still a big percentage of your portfolio. Don't have enough time to do that today, so I'm just going to flag for folks. Go watch the video that I just released this week with Jeff Clark. He's goldsilver.com's precious metals mining analyst, and he gives a very detailed update on the entire mining sector. So that's the best way to get the full details on that. Last, folks, if you enjoyed Stephanie as a guest host here again, which I loved. And you'd like to see her come back on the program again. Also see Peter come back on as a guest expert. Do me a favor and support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And Mike and John, whatever happens in the markets from here, we don't know for certain what it's going to be, but we do know for certain we'll be tracking it here next week together. Thanks so much for joining me, and everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thanks, Adam. We'll see you soon.
Thank you, Adam. We'll see you next week.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth. And because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type. The kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry. The market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the Wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-US clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to wealthion.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.